and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I am Erin.
And I am Shay.
And we have a doozy of a case today, as Shay has told me many a time.
It's a complicated one, but we're going to get into it. Like I was saying to you earlier, it's like a backloaded contract for a professional athlete. This case is heavy on the details on the second half. Front half, kind of weird and vague. A lot of our cases that we do are heavy on the details, very thorough on the first half. The nature of this case is dubious, but it's very interesting. And so hold on to the second half of this one, and we're going to get to some really interesting stuff, I think.
All right, sounds great. But before we get started, we did have one little announcement for you guys, and that is the meetup that we have going on this Monday at the Dallas Stars versus Edmonton Oilers game.
The old Oilers. Yep, that's right. One of our awesome fans and producer of the show, Lisa L., has set up a meetup months ago for us to come hang out at the Edmonton Oilers-Dallas Stars game together. Also, we're going to meet up beforehand at the Happiest Hour, which is just near the arena. We're going to have some beverages, some food. It's going to be really fun. I think everybody's going to have a good time. If you haven't purchased your tickets through the Fevo link that we posted, there are still some available. And if you want to get a hold of those, you can contact Lisa L. on the Facebook post that we put out, and you can get access to those via PayPal. Also, there are some tickets still available for resale on Ticketmaster. Those range between like $15 and $35 a piece. But whatever, if you want to meet Mike from Dark Poutine, who's gonna be there and it's gonna be really cool, how cool is it that Mike is coming to town?
I feel like more people are gonna be excited to meet him than to meet us.
Well, Mike is a big to-do, really.
He is a veritable star.
Yeah. Well, anyways, if you want to meet us and Mike and check out a Dallas Stars versus a Canadian team and sing both anthems for both countries at the same time, let's do it on Monday. So now that that is out of the way, we're on to this case in particular. It's the notorious axe murders of Laredo, Texas. First off, let's talk about some sources. We got a lot of them. Let's go through them real quick. So the San Antonio Express news articles that came out back in the 90s were kind of the premier early release of all this information. Those are really important. They were written by Dane Schiller. There was a documentary that came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, written and directed by a Swedish documentarian named Folke Riden. And this documentary is not talked about very often, but it's very, very good. And it's a two-part series. It's hard to find. If you do a little bit of Googling online, you can find it. It's very good. It's called Laredo and the Law. Next up, we have a book written by Liza Jeanette in 2010 called God Save Me from Death Row. They call this a book, but it's really a collection of interviews. It's very interesting if you take it with a big grain of salt. There's a lot of telling information in here that you should check out. The reason you've probably heard about this case is from the I Am a Killer episode from the new show on Netflix. It's season 1, episode 4 from 2018. This is a really controversial episode of the show, and you'll see why as we get into this. We got some court appeals and some court testimony and documents from online from various sources like findacase.com and law.justia.com. You can Google those. Also, another local paper that did a really good job was myplainview.com, written by Alex Mooring back in 2004. We also used a UK news publication called The Sun. This was written by George Harrison recently because of the show and kind of...
The Beatle?
No, not George Harrison, the Beatle, who wrote My Guitar Gently Weeps. This is a journalist in the UK who did a really good job of laying out this case once we've kind of gotten reintroduced to it because of this Netflix show. I also used a couple opinion pieces that we'll talk about at the end from crimeinvestigation.co.uk. That one was uncredited. And from newsrepublic.com by Josephine Livingston from this year. Now, we just recently, in the last handful of episodes, did a case on Laredo, Texas with the Laredo serial killer, right? Well, in that previous episode, we talked a little bit about Laredo's history and how it functions as one of the major border towns between Texas and Mexico. But what we didn't discuss is Laredo's international sister city, Nuevo Laredo. So Nuevo Laredo is located across the Mexican border. It's in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas. Together, these two cities make up a metropolitan area known as the Two Laredos and the Laredo Borderplex. With a combined population of 775,000 people, this international urban area makes up one of the largest international metroplexes in North and South America. Nuevo Laredo and the Greater Laredo area are known for their six international crossings along the Rio Grande. These crossing points help provide Texas with a whopping 50% of their international trade, and Mexico with around 40% of their entire nation's international trade revenue. Did you know that about Laredo?
I knew it was a major crossing point for goods, but I didn't know it was quite that large. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's a very important town, and also I had never really considered international border plexes, so that's interesting that there's that kind of demographic, socioeconomical zone set up. One of the other things this area is known for, which may or may not be a surprise to you, is mission work. That's right. There's a lot of Christian faiths that have set up shop just over the banks of the Rio Grande to spread their various religious teachings and messages. It's no surprise that during the summer months, many Texans and U.S. students from across the country travel to this area to volunteer, to build churches, dig wells, teach English, and participate in a wide variety of missionary work throughout the Nuevo Laredo region. One of these individuals was 33-year-old James Smiley. When James wasn't working at his Arby's franchise, he was leading services as one of the ministers at his local First Baptist Church. James spent a lot of time and effort traveling back and forth to Nuevo Laredo to assist an underserved orphanage in one of their more impoverished neighborhoods. James naturally took to working with kids. He led a large youth group at his First Baptist Church back in Laredo, Texas. Jay Dickey, James's pastor, spoke in the Netflix documentary about James at length. He said he was, quote, the sort of person who would give you the shirt off of his back. James was also known for taking in troubled and impoverished youths into his home and giving them a place to stay when they had nowhere else to go. Several of those young men even got jobs at that particular Arby's location that James helped to open a few years earlier. In 1991, James Smiley was considered by many in the community to have a great sense of humor, a loving personality, and also to be a generous man who was doing God's work along the Texas border. Now, the crime that I'm about to cover shocked the city of Laredo for decades to come and left many residents wondering how such a thing could have happened. On January 18th, 1991, a friend and co-worker of James Smiley's, Jesse Garcia, became very worried about James because he hadn't shown up to work at Arby's that day. That evening, Jesse went over to James's house to check and see if he was home. When he arrived at James's house, he saw a couple of vehicles in the driveway and assumed he was home. Jesse was also aware that James Smiley had taken in two young men recently until they could get a place of their own and kind of get back on their feet. These two men were Daniel Duenez, 14, and Ruben Martinez, 22. Jesse tried knocking on the door, got no answer. So he went and grabbed a flashlight and looked through some windows and saw multiple people not moving and also what looked like blood inside. Jesse decided to break one of the windows and go inside and find out what happened for himself. He quickly discovered James Smiley and two other victims in the home who had been brutally murdered. Ruben Martinez was dead on the couch in the living room. In a back bedroom, the youngest, Daniel Duendez, was sprawled out in a clutter of items. He was dead as well. And then finally, James Smiley was discovered dead in the master bedroom. Jesse quickly exited the home and ran to the nearest phone that he could find, called the police to alert everybody what he'd just found. I can't even imagine being Jesse Garcia at this point. Ugh, that's a horrible thing to find, right?
Yeah, it is horrible. So did he go through the whole house and find each body?
Yeah. Yeah, by himself, like just room to room, just it's one horror after another, discovering what happened in this home that all of your acquaintances and, you know, one of your shift managers from the place that you work is dead.
Yeah, and especially horrible considering that one of them was a 14-year-old. Jeez.
Yeah, just a kid.
Yeah.
Jesus Torres, a homicide detective with the Laredo Police Department, led the investigation at this crime scene. They received the call at LPD. They paged Jesus Torres, and he got there as fast as he could. An officer Torres arrived and got a short briefing from another officer who was the first to arrive. According to the San Antonio Express News, this officer simply told Detective Torres, quote, "It's horrible in there. We've got three victims inside, all deceased. It's terrible." Detective Torres immediately knew this was not a typical homicide case upon entering the home because this scene was something out of a horror movie. Each victim was in a different room of the home. All victims had multiple slashes and stab wounds on their bodies, and the most horrific detail was that their heads had seemingly been crushed in violently by large impacts from what looked like a sizable, heavy, and sharp weapon.
So what would that be, like a machete or?
At the time, they were thinking like a kind of like a claw hammer or like a machete or an axe or something big and weighty and sharp.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So we already have clearly two different weapons, judging from the wounds on the bodies. So I would assume that they would kind of be going off of the idea that this was more than one perpetrator of the crimes.
That was Detective Torres's thought. He noted that all three victims appeared to have been asleep at the time of the murders. So that's kind of how these intruders got the jump on them.
Kind of a good thing, when you think about it.
Well, except for one victim, the youngest, in the side bedroom, you know, the one that was in the clutter, they showed signs that they had actually tried to fight off their attacker before their eventual death. So... terrifying.
Yeah. So this is something that happened maybe in the wee hours of the morning or very late at night. You know, we're thinking maybe multiple perpetrators and that they just kind of snuck around this house trying to kill all three victims.
Yes. And Detective Torres told San Antonio Express News back in 1991 that while he was investigating this crime, he just was shocked by, quote, the way that they were killed. And, you know, you try to think of their last moments and what they were feeling and what was going on. It's one of those crimes that would remain in anybody's mind. Well, now Assistant Chief Torres has since commented multiple times about how this case haunts him, even to this day after all of these years. And that's pretty much because he still doesn't know what actually happened. One of the final things that Detective Torres noted at the crime scene was a crucifix that had been inverted in the master bedroom near James Smiley's dead body. Now, when I say crucifix, I'm talking about a decorative kind of religious object that kind of sits on a nightstand next to your bed. This particular crucifix is solid metal, and it sat in a wooden base, and it was pulled out of the base, turned upside down, and placed back as a specific sign. Like, James Smiley would never have had his crucifix in such a position.
Yeah, and it's not like it was toppled over from a struggle or anything, if it's something that had to be placed in such a way.
Yeah, it was purposeful.
Okay, so we've got an upside down crucifix and we've got three dead bodies.
And not only that, but you also had two missing items from the home, which was James Smiley's vehicle and his television.
Oh, okay. So the vehicle's outside that Jesse saw.
One of them was missing, and it was James Smiley's vehicle. The other two were just two other vehicles. One of them might have belonged to Ruben, I think.
Yeah.
But either way, one of them was missing. So you have also this element of a possible burglary involved now. So you've got three things. You've got a triple homicide. You've got seemingly maybe some occult activities involved with this murder and a burglary.
Yeah. And you said this happened in
1991.
So this is right in the wheelhouse of the satanic panic and everything. So I'm assuming that's going to be sort of a major contributing thing in this story.
Once that gets out, it has a whole life of its own. So we'll get into that in just a second. So this investigation, it becomes really clear that this is not a normal homicide in Laredo. This is not a normal burglary. So they pull their resources and they get everybody involved. And over the next 48 hours, they're actually able to discover a lot about the case. So 2 days later, investigators are able to locate James Smiley's car at a local hospital there in Laredo. An informant who was arrested on a DWI charge provided some key information to investigators. He basically got pulled over drunk and said, "Hey, I've got some info you guys might want to know about these murders that have been in the paper." He not only planned to sell James Smiley's stolen vehicle, but he also knew the people who had stole it. And he was able to give investigators the names of these three young Laredo men who had stolen his vehicle. While arranging to offload James Smiley's vehicle, one of them had implied to the informant they were responsible for the horrific recent murders. The first of these young men who supposedly stole James Smiley's vehicle to be apprehended and brought in for questioning was 17-year-old Milo Flores. He worked at the hospital where that vehicle was parked in a blood lab. How weird is that?
Yeah, that's really weird.
It also, you know, kind of signals that you might have had something to do with why his car was there, why you're also named in this case by somebody else who said you're trying to sell this recently murdered guy's car.
Yeah, it's very suspicious.
Yeah. Well, Milo Flores was also the son of a prominent district judge, Manuel Flores Sr., who was a state judge in state courts. He was arrested, brought in for questioning. They talked to him a little bit, and they also found another name based on Milo's statements to detectives. They found out about Miguel Angel Venegas, who is a 16-year-old local troublemaker who's also a self-admitted Satanist. Seemed like there's another tie-in there with the crucifix.
Sure.
Okay.
So what is the son of a prominent judge doing hanging out with some Satanist troublemaker?
Well, they were buddies, and we're going to get into their relationship as we go through this. After speaking to Venegas, as well as Milo, they found the last of the three suspects involved in this case, which was Miguel Angel Martinez, who was 17 at the time. He was at home, and they went over and arrested him, brought him in for questioning, took some statements from him, too. But from here on out, Miguel Angel Martinez and Miguel Angel Venegas, we got some name confusion there. From this point on, I'm just going to say Venegas when I'm talking about Venegas, and then I'll say Miguel Martinez when I'm talking about Martinez.
Okay, Venegas is the Satan guy, right?
Yes.
And Martinez is this last guy.
Yes, Miguel Angel Martinez is this last guy. He's kind of an honor student, a smart kid who seemed like he might be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we're going to really get into his background here shortly.
Okay. So we have kind of like a ragtag group of individuals.
Yeah, a motley crew that we really need to learn more about and how they came together and how these people became involved with this crime. And, you know, like, how did this happen? So Miguel Martinez was also the same age as Milo Flores, the son of the judge. However, much more disadvantaged compared to Milo Flores. Miguel Martinez came from a broken home, very impoverished neighborhood, but Miguel Martinez was an honor student and had a very good reputation in the community and a lot of community support. That's why it was weird when it became very clear that the prosecution planned to throw the book at Miguel Martinez and label him and his friend Venegas as solely responsible for what appeared to be a horrific triple homicide, which was possibly linked to occult activities in the area. The Laredo community, as well as DA Joe Rubio, declared that they wanted swift justice in this case, and that was what they were going to get. Miguel Martinez was the first to head to trial a year later. So this next section that I'm going to go over, I'm going to do it kind of quickly, and we're just going to do a cursory glance over some of these trials and hearings. There's a lot of stuff to go through. I'm going to do it really quickly because this is not the meat and potatoes of the case. The really important, interesting stuff comes later once we unearth a lot of really telling things about this particular case. So Miguel's trial was very controversial. It appeared to some that it was simply ramrodded through the judicial system for a quick conviction based on a series of elements that investigators in the DA office had put together. There are three main things that dominated Miguel Martinez's trial. First, was the fact that Miguel and Venegas had confessed to the police. Investigators had their written confessions to these murders. Miguel also admitted he had suggested Smiley's home as the target for a potential burglary in the planning phase. Second was testimony from forensic specialist Fred Zane, who looked at the blood evidence at this crime scene. Based on blood spatter analysis found near the victims and fingerprinting on the murder weapons themselves, it was his determination that Miguel and Venegas were responsible for all three murders. The last part of the damning evidence came from accomplice Milo Flores. Milo Flores confessed he had supplied the axe, the two knives, that were eventually used in these killings. Both Milo and Venegas cited that planning of the robbery was due to Miguel's supplying of James Smiley's residence and access to the home. It's also worth noting here that Miguel decided to plead innocent based on advice from his court-appointed attorney, a former divorce lawyer who had never defended a client facing capital murder charges and seemed to be completely in over his head.
Yeah, that's not great. That's not really what you want out of your defense attorney.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in this situation, you're a 17-year-old kid, maybe even made some really horrific bad decisions, you most likely should probably plead out if you have any guilt, right?
I mean, unless you have a very solid defense.
Or if you believe you're innocent.
Yes, of course.
Well, Miguel Martinez was quickly convicted for capital murder of James Smiley, Ruben Martinez, and Daniel Duenez when his defense didn't go very well. Since he was younger than J. Kelly Pinkerton, who we covered in a recent episode of the Amarillo Slasher case, Miguel became the youngest person to be sentenced to Texas's death row. Next up, we have to talk about his accomplice, Miguel Venegas. So in his trial, unlike in Martinez's case, Venegas took years to finally see his day in court. This is due to the fact that he managed to escape from a juvenile detention facility back in December of 1993. Venegas somehow got a hold of a gun and forced his way out of this facility and eventually fled into Mexico. It would take two more years before Mexican authorities apprehended Venegas in Monterrey, Mexico. Authorities there turned him over to the U.S. so he could return back and face his trial for the Laredo triple homicide. A few more years are thrown in because the Texas judicial system decided they needed to have him psychologically evaluated if he could be tried as an adult or not. So they send in these court-appointed psychologists who do a series of very in-depth interviews and analyses on Venegas. And they figure out that he has some real problems with religion, Satanism, schizophrenia, he hears voices, and then there's just a court battle that goes on whether he should be tried as a juvenile or an adult. Well, in 2004, Venegas pled guilty to three counts of murder and was sentenced to 41 years in prison. He got a lesser sentence because he was a minor and 16 at the time. Venegas has been eligible for parole ever since he completed 1/4 of his sentence, which should have already happened, but since he had some altercations and some run-ins in prison, he's continually been denied for parole.
Yeah, especially if he's already escaped that juvenile detention center.
He's not made his case very good for parole, that's for sure. Milo Flores, on the other hand, has never been charged for his role in these three murders because he's fully cooperated with police. He's testified in both cases. He also claims that in the day questioned, he never went into James Smiley's home. Merely, he was only the driver for Venegas and Martinez.
Well, drivers can still be party to murder even if they didn't even enter the house. So I think it's pretty clear that Mr. I am the son of a prominent judge might have something to do with that. But also the evidence didn't really seem to go his way, right? So you mentioned earlier that that forensic analyst found blood spatter that pointed to the two other boys. And then what were their fingerprints?
That's what he claimed.
Okay. So at least what was presented in trial, there was no actual direct forensic evidence tying Milo to the scene.
Correct. And we're going to get into that because that's a huge point of contention. And like I said, I knew you were going to want to be an armchair detective in this case and ask all those questions, which is good on you because nobody else stood up and asked those questions at the time of the trials, which they should have.
Okay.
that's the end of our story, right? I mean, we have confessions, convictions, families supposedly got justice, and we're all ready to move on from this, right? End of episode. Nope. Thanks to a bunch of lawyers, documentarians, Redditors, online petitioners, and wrongful conviction activists, we have a whole lot more to talk about. So many questions at this point, right? I mean, you've mentioned a few, but we don't really know what happened that night and how it really went down. We need to have more details. We need to look at this forensic evidence. And that's why these documentaries, the Swedish one and the Netflix documentary, have been so popular. So in order to do this, we need to go back and we need to kind of figure out how this motley crew of people came together. Let's start by outlining the background of Miguel Martinez. Martinez was born in Laredo, Texas, August 6, 1973. In his early years, he moved back and forth across the border between Laredo and Nuevo Laredo. This was due to his mother, Ruth Martinez, who worked in Laredo until she was able to find a stable place to settle her, Miguel, and his younger brother and sister down. Miguel never knew his father. Until the age of 11, Miguel and his two siblings lived with his grandmother in Nuevo Laredo, and thus he was able to have dual citizenship. Miguel had a strong connection to his church and a religious background, and that was at a congregation of the Church of the Nazarene. By all accounts, from within his community and his family members, he was a happy and smart boy. His mother remembers him as a child that rarely cried, who was always happy and made sure to look after his two siblings. When his mother, Ruth, came for the children once she had settled down, she put them into public school in Laredo, and Miguel excelled immediately. By fifth grade, he was moved into a magnet program for gifted and talented children at Nye Elementary. From this magnet program to his early high school years, Miguel always tested well. He had a high aptitude, a high IQ. He was always in honors classes. His teachers even said he was a gifted and talented child that you always had to constantly challenge. Miguel also excelled at sports, including volleyball, soccer, and basketball. Everything in Miguel's life seemed to be going really well. But by his final year of high school, Miguel had begun to hang out with the wrong crowd. Now, Milo Flores plays a big part of this circle of friends, as Milo was well off. He lived in a nice neighborhood, and as we mentioned before, his father was a district judge. Well, according to Miguel, Milo let him into his inner circle of friends once they met in high school in a class. Milo lived in an add-on apartment on the Flores property, kind of had free reign of this, you know, small apartment. And what happens when you're a teenager and you have free reign of your own apartment, Aaron?
You have a lot of parties.
Yep, that's right. He had access to expensive video games, parties, booze, and occasionally drugs. All things that were exciting and exotic to an impoverished young Miguel Martinez. So you can imagine Martinez at this point, you know, he's not used to all these things. This is a whole new world that he's getting access to. Well, according to Miguel, Milo was a daily user of several drugs, including cocaine, marijuana, huffing glue, and psychedelic mushrooms. Miguel found himself spending more and more time out partying and even staying at Milo's apartment. Miguel also started to lose focus on his studies, his part-time job at Arby's. Sound familiar?
Oh.
Uh-huh, there's a connection so there.
Did he work at that same Arby's?
The same Arby's that James Smiley helped open.
Interesting. Okay.
He also lost focus on his sports activities and even spending time with his family, who he had always been close to in the past. Miguel claims he started stealing things with Milo for cash to buy drugs, booze, and the respect of his newfound peers. Milo Flores was close friends with Venegas. See, Miguel didn't know Venegas very well. Venegas was a friend of Milo's. Both of them shared a certain passion for partying, but more interestingly, they shared a unique fascination with the occult. A year earlier, Milo wrote a controversial essay at high school regarding sacrificing living things to gain benefits from Satan, and he also talked about Satanism with some of his friends in that class. One of them was Venegas.
Wow, okay, that's pretty out there.
Yeah, you know, he got into some trouble, and that attracted Venegas to him. Miguel Martinez saw these strange beliefs of Venegas and Milo as a fad and something that they used to kind of make themselves look cool or dangerous amongst their inner circle. Venegas, on the other hand, has spoken out about his personal satanic beliefs in several interviews and to court-appointed psychiatrists. From these documents, it is clear that Venegas has or had a deep belief in the power of Satan and the practice of sacrifice. It goes back to the point where he was 8 years old, living in Mexico at the time. He supposedly filled some jars with black widow spiders, and he dumped them onto his chest and then celebrated when he was not bitten.
That's pretty weird.
I hate spiders. I hate this idea of doing this, and it all seems nutso to me. But to Venegas, he took this as a sign that Satan had blessed him as a servant, and later claimed that this was the moment that he knew he was in fact the son of the devil.
Oh, wow. That's a stretch.
Yeah, definitely. Quite a leap you took there, Venegas. I've pieced together the following account of the fateful events of January 17th, 1991 from several interviews with Miguel Martinez and Venegas during their appeals processes as well as the aforementioned documentaries. This version of the events might give us a clearer view of why and how this triple homicide happened. It all starts back when Miguel Martinez was hanging out at Milo Flores' apartment that evening. Venegas showed up, they all started using drugs, cocaine, weed, mushrooms, and playing video games.
It seems like a really bad cocktail. Cocaine, weed, and mushrooms?
That seems like a lot.
Yeah, and conflicting things that those drugs do to you.
Yeah, it might not have been they were all imbibing in those things, but different
they
things
were available.
Separately.
Okay. Yeah,
because I think Venegas was really into the cocaine, and so he started getting really amped up. And after a few hours, according to Miguel Martinez, Venegas suggested that they go steal something for fun, maybe vandalize something or trash a house. Miguel Martinez mentioned he knew a home that they could target. It was the home of James Smiley. A year earlier, James had allowed Miguel to stay with him and had even given him a job at that Arby's that he managed. James made Miguel a set of keys so that he could come and go as he pleased. James also gave Miguel rides back and forth to work since they worked similar shifts, and Miguel claimed that he suggested James's home as the one that they should target because he and Milo had burglarized the home before for drug money.
Wow.
Yeah, Miguel also has like this intimate connection with James Smiley as like a father figure and like someone that he really wanted to help, but also he doesn't really want to talk about James Smiley, and we'll get into that too here in just a second.
So this guy was so kind to him, and that's the number one place he decided to go to.
Maybe. Or was he? We're going to get into their relationship a little bit more because that's something the Netflix documentary really left out and left a lot of people on a cliffhanger. And that's one of the driving questions why I wanted to do this case. So back to the crime at hand. That evening, Milo, then trying to aid his two friends, took them all out to a shed on their property and armed them with an axe and two knives. Milo claimed he drove the three of them to James Smiley's street and dropped off Venegas and Martinez a couple of blocks from James Smiley's home. Milo was supposed to circle the block a few times, wait for them to come back out and pick them up, but he claims he got scared and took off. Meanwhile, Venegas and Martinez walked up to James Smiley's home using Miguel's key. Venegas went inside to scout out the house. Venegas said the house was not empty as Martinez had expected. Three people were inside.
Well, if they expected the house to be empty, why did they bring along axes and knives?
All great questions. We don't really know.
Okay.
I think Milo claims that he wanted to arm them with just an axe and some knives because he thought it would be better than a handgun, which he also had access to, so that's kind of a point in Milo's favor that I could have lethally armed them, but they wanted to trash a house, so I just gave them some knives and an axe.
So I just gave him an axe.
Yeah, well, that's his argument.
That's more terrifying than a gun.
Well, when Venegas came out and said that there were people inside, Martinez reportedly said, hey, we need to call this off and we need to leave. Venegas declined, and he insisted that they go in and kill the three men because, quote, Satan demanded their souls. Martinez eventually relented, snuck back in with Venegas, and under the cloak of darkness on that quiet January Texas night, Venegas took the axe that Milo had provided them, and he struck the young Reuben in the head right there on the living room couch. Reuben squirmed. Venegas stabbed the 22-year-old several times in the abdomen, And then afterwards, Venegas suffocated Ruben with a pillow to make sure he was dead.
Jeez.
According to Miguel Martinez, the man stopped moving. Venegas then directed him to stab the victim to prove his worth. Miguel said he poked at the victim, kind of noncommittally, with the knife to appease Venegas because he was terrified of him and in shock. Miguel's confession to police was much more vague, saying things like, quote, "I helped Venegas to kill a man on Smiley's couch," or, quote, "We then killed the other two." Very weird, like, prepared blanket statements. Not very detailed, like his later interviews are. Miguel now claims he fled out the door of the house and began vomiting on the front lawn after being forced to stab the already dead Ruben Martinez. Venegas went out, talked to Miguel. He tried to convince him to go back inside to finish the job.
So is that true? Was there vomit collected at the scene of the crime?
There was not a vomit collected, but both of their statements and interviews after the fact kind of corroborate this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's weird. Why wouldn't it have been collected?
We don't know. There's some questionable forensics in this case that we're going to get to.
Okay. Because I'm assuming you could get DNA. Of course, this is 1991, so never mind. Okay. Yep,
that's a big part of it. So when Venegas came out and tried to talk to him, Martinez refused to go back inside. Venegas reportedly took the axe back in and committed the next two murders alone. According to later interviews with both Venegas and Martinez, the murders of Daniel Duenez and James Smiley were solely the actions of Venegas in a satanic, drug-riddled high. It was also made clear by statements from Venegas that he was the one to overturn the crucifix as he left James Smiley's bedroom that night. He then stole the TV and told Martinez that they were going to steal the car. And then they left, met up with Milo later, and yada, yada, yada. We know the story from there.
So Martinez got sent to death row.
Yes.
But according to this story, all he did was stab somebody after they were dead.
That's the whole reason we're doing this case. And it took so long to get to this point. I'm sorry. But yes, that's the real question. Was his case ramrodded through too quickly? And did we take a close enough look at the relationship of these three individuals and the forensics of the case? And that's what we're about to do.
So did Venegas also corroborate this story, or is this just coming from Martinez?
No, these are two sets of different interviews with psychiatrists that were court appointed, and then documentaries where they both pretty much agree about what I just said.
Yeah, so even Venegas said, oh no, he didn't kill any of them with me. He just kind of stabbed at the one guy after he was deceased.
Yes. And Venegas says that Martinez is a little more involved than he wants to claim that he was, and that there's some more reasoning behind why they went there.
Okay. All right.
Do you see why I told you earlier this is a really difficult case to cover?
Yes. It seems very convoluted and very confusing.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And I hope you followed us to this point because we're going to get into the meat and potatoes right now.
Oh, let's do it. I'm excited.
All right. So where does this version of the events leave us? Does Miguel Martinez's sentence fit his role in the crime if any of these accounts are in fact true? There's a difference between capital murder and death row versus what Venegas received, which was 41 years with a chance of parole, and also what Milo Flores received, which was nothing. Diddly squat. I don't know if I have any answers to you in this case, but I have some clues and I have some interesting discussion points. And I certainly know that Miguel's current lawyer, who is a wrongful conviction lawyer, Cynthia Orr, has taken up his case for this very freaking reason. She believes Miguel deserves a complete retrial for several reasons. First, let's talk about that confession that Miguel gave. Miguel argues, and has for some time, that he was taken from his home and interrogated in a room for several hours and then forced to sign a false confession. Miguel told documentarian Folk Ryden, quote, "They told me what to write, sometimes word for word, line for line. I did it, and then I signed it." Several of Miguel's appeals have called into question this confession. Miguel and his attorneys claim detectives forced him to sign a prepared confession by threatening him that they would turn Miguel over to Nuevo Laredo police. Remember that dual citizenship. Liza Jeanette, the lawyer from the book God Save Me from Death Row, she asked Miguel about this alleged coerced statement specifically. Miguel told her that the detectives and the DA himself threatened him due to his dual citizenship with Mexico. They reportedly told him if he didn't cooperate and sign the statement, they would turn him over to corrupt judiciales who would likely do worse to him than they would.
Yeah, and we're also considering that this is a 17-year-old kid.
Yeah, he doesn't know anything.
And then on top of that, like, I'm not saying I necessarily agree that this is coerced. I don't know the full story yet.
Sure.
But we do have to acknowledge the fact that we know, as true crime people, everybody listening out there, we know that false confessions happen all the time.
Yeah, and this definitely has signs of it, and that's why his lawyer took up this case to begin with.
I can see all of that, yeah, so far. Okay.
That's what I'm saying. The other side of the story is illuminating and makes you go, oh, okay, well, there's some answers to some of the questions I had early on. Well, Miguel claims that this is why he signed the statement and has continued to fight against it ever since. Milo's cooperation with the police and sworn statement was another damning factor. So there you have an accomplice who brought them to the scene and gave a statement. However, according to sworn statements provided by DA Joe Rubio's sister-in-law, there was a secret meeting early on in the investigation between D.A. Rubio and Judge Flores, who was Milo's father.
Ooh.
Yes, so you got this old turd to deal with. Well, Miguel Martinez's attorney, Cynthia Orr, provided her analysis of these sworn statements in an appeals hearing during the documentary Laredo and the Law, saying, quote, Judge Flores made a deal with the prosecutors to make certain that his son would never be prosecuted.
Oh my God. That is so twisted and awful, if that's true.
Yeah. Well, Judge Flores and DA Rubio both obviously deny these allegations, but the incident has left a dark stain on their families and both of their professional reputations. I will also point out that DA Joe Rubio was in an election year in 1992 during Miguel's trial. So perhaps there was a certain air of appearing tough on crime, getting a quick conviction and promoting his new reelection. We don't know.
Yeah, but again, it does look mighty suspicious.
It doesn't look good.
Yeah.
Now, let's get into some of the early 90s forensics going on in this case, specifically when it refers to the blood expert, Fred Zane.
Yes, I'm very interested to see the details on that.
Well, he was a key witness in Miguel's original trial. He examined both the axe and the knives, as well as blood evidence at the scene. Zane's analysis, which helped to condemn Miguel, was called into question years later. And that's because he gained a reputation for backing up prosecutors blindly and also received two indictments from falsifying blood evidence.
Oh, great.
So this case was immediately flagged for audit by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice for possible wrongful conviction. So they go through from time to time and do these audits. This one got flagged because somebody who was a key scientific witness provided information who's had charges brought up on them. So, hey, we need to look at this one. In fact, Fred Zane's forensic work has been a key component in numerous wrongful conviction lawsuits as well as overturned convictions across the nation. When renowned forensic specialist Jerry Goldstein later tested the murder weapons for appeals proceedings, he determined it was impossible to find any comparative blood samples or DNA evidence on any of the three items or in the evidence archives. He did, however, find traces of animal blood on the infamous axe, which he thought was really weird. So, he referred back to Zane's forensic notes as well as the case files. After review, Goldstein determined it was quite possible that Zane had never actually completed any analysis or testing of the weapons at all.
What?
Yes, he also found that Zane's blood spatter analysis was completely lacking and inconclusive with regards to Miguel's guilt in the crime and there being two attackers. Goldstein proposes, based on his own analysis of the blood spatter, that there was a single attacker, specifically when it pertains to James Smiley, as well as David Duenas. So, the story that we put out to you earlier of Venegas going into the bedroom, killing young David, and then going and killing James could actually be true.
Yeah, the evidence seems to support that a little bit better. Not conclusively, but a little bit better.
Yeah. It's okay. Not as a smoking gun as Zane led us to believe in the original trial. That's for sure. Also, these are some really damning allegations against a key scientific witness in a capital murder case. which leads to a whole slew of other appeals processes that open up. It doesn't stop there, though, because lawyer Cynthia Orr cites that tests and appeals hearings of Miguel's case showed that the LPD used the axe in question to trim an office Christmas tree, and by doing so have destroyed valuable fingerprint evidence that could have exonerated Miguel during the appeals proceedings if that axe had Venegas's fingerprints on it and not Miguel's.
I'm sorry, what did you just say?
Yeah.
They used evidence in a triple homicide to trim a tree?
Yes.
How does that even happen?
I don't know, man, but we got more to cover, so we gotta get to it.
We gotta move on from that? My mind is blown away.
Well, if your mind's blown now, speaking of the fingerprints, let's talk about this dubious situation. All fingerprints taken at the scene, which we see being taken in police videotapes that were shown to us in various documentaries, have all been lost and possibly destroyed. Reason why? There's no official reason why. This discovery drew intense scrutiny by the Laredo community as well as the media. Members of the Laredo City Council began their own investigation as to what happened to these missing fingerprints, especially when you combine that with the axe and how those fingerprints were contaminated. Whose fingerprints are at the house? Where's all the forensic evidence? We're losing evidence day by day as we constantly look back at this case. Based on the findings of these investigations by the city council into the LPD and the DA office, council member Pancho Caso gave several interviews stating, quote, "Certain people needed to be protected, and in this case, the best way to do that was to lose or destroy evidence." What does that sound like? He seems to think that somebody's being protected by this, the destruction of all this evidence.
Yeah, and of course—
Who do you think that person
is?
Yeah,
of course it's Milo Flores. Wow.
Yeah. D.A. Rubio actually had Pancho Caso jailed for his aggressive witch hunt in this case.
Wow.
Yeah, he had charges brought up against him, and it pretty much destroyed Pancho Caso's political career. He's still an advocate for criminal justice in the Laredo community. He's still an active civil rights advocate, too. This case and the related allegations of corruption even drew the ire of the FBI. Several charges have since been lobbied at the DA office and the LPD. A few convictions have even been made due to bribery and falsifying of evidence. All that being said, the missing fingerprints have never been found. The missing forensics in the house have never been found. Okay. Oof. So this point of the case is where we now have to get into the really unfortunate part where we have to address James Smiley and allegations of molestation, drugging, and raping of young boys under his care. Now, during this section, remember, as Brian always tells us from the Canine Crime Unit, alleged, alleged, alleged. Most of this started when Venegas started claiming James Smiley was a known pedophile in the community of Laredo during his interviews with court-appointed psychiatrists, and this is when they were trying to determine if Venegas could be tried as an adult, or if he could also be determined as mentally sane. Richard Gonzalez, Venegas' lawyer at this time, spoke about these allegations in the Laredo and the Law documentary. Regarding Smiley, he said, quote, "It seems to me some of the circumstances surrounding Smiley's lifestyle were suspect." He goes on to say, "I think Smiley came here because we live next to a third world country that has a steady stream of children readily available for whatever. And it seems kind of odd that Smiley had a 14-year-old boy staying at his house who was not employed at the Arby's." Miguel has stated that Smiley tried to inappropriately touch him sexually on several occasions. James Smiley's living situation with young men and boys has been questioned before, but the local religious community in Laredo has vehemently defended his memory to this day.
Okay, so now we have possible motive, basically, as to why Miguel Martinez would have suggested the Smiley residence either to rob or to do worse.
Yes, and this was insinuated in the Netflix show. And this is like the main driving factor behind why I needed to keep asking questions as to why did this happen? What is going on here? And I battled with addressing these allegations myself in this episode, but after doing some more digging, I did find that Miguel's lawyer, Cynthia Orr, was able to obtain a book that was found in James Smiley's bedroom and put into evidence. It was called Sexual Knowledge. It's a German book, and it has a disturbing cover that features a naked grown man, a woman, as well as a kneeling naked male child. This book contains detailed information regarding sex with children.
What?
Yeah, it's really weird and perverted. If you do some more searching around, you'll find some more rumors, as well as this book. But these rumors from alleged victims and their friends and family members are posted on all these forums all over, speaking out about James Smiley and his dangerous nature. Many of these rumors are eerily similar. A common thread among them is the mention of drugging young boys, unwanted sexual advances, inappropriate touching, and even rape.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was going to ask is, especially as this story has kind of gotten a foothold and become more known, have there been other victims to come out? And it sounds like there have been.
Only online. I have to clarify, there's never been any formal charges or official complaints or police charges or police reports that were filed that we can look at and say, hey, here's a clear history of this kind of activity. But it does raise an interesting question. Why is this book in his house? Why are all these people coming forward, talking about how he treated these young men? It's weird just to take young men in anyway, especially at the age that, you know, Daniel was at 14. That's questionable. If you're a 33-year-old man.
I mean, it's one of those things where that could be the most innocent thing in the world, or it can be exactly what these things are alluding to, where this is a predator.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I'm not suggesting that he was, but I mean, all of us have heard these kinds of stories before where these things unfortunately happen. So it is something that you have to look at.
Yeah,
especially if there's been numerous allegations, even if they've been online, even if they haven't been anything where somebody has come out and wanted to do interviews or anything like that. Well, we know that that's not, you know, victims of those kinds of assaults don't want to do those things.
Yeah.
They want their privacy, but they still want to get their word out. And sometimes just posting online is the best way to do that.
Well, that's a great point because, you know, according to Miguel, he's never really spoken out about Smiley and these possible allegations. But Liza Jeanette's interviews with Miguel hit home on this very point when she directly asked him, quote, "Were you ever molested by any of the victims?" Miguel responded with, quote, "Although I do not look at myself as being a victim under the legal definition of it, yes, I was." Liza continued with the questioning, saying, quote, "It was rumored that you were romantically involved with one of the victims. Is this true?" Clearly referring to Smiley. Miguel responded with, quote, "If the inappropriate sexual contact with Smiley was the basis of this rumor, it is a very perverted view of romance." Again, he's eloquent. He's a smart person. He knows how to construct his thoughts. And it also seems like he never really wanted to talk about this. Like you're saying, like, you know, it's hard for victims of sexual assault and molestation and rape to come forward and put that out there and put themselves in the spotlight, especially in 1991.
Especially in 1991. And honestly, especially if the victims are male, it's a lot more difficult for men to come forward because there's that added, you know, that feeling of humiliation, of embarrassment when you've been victimized by another man.
Yeah. Well, according to his lawyer, Cynthia Orr, during the time that Miguel lived with James Smiley, Miguel claims, and this is over a series of interviews she's done with him, that he was molested on multiple occasions. Cynthia also believes this could be an ulterior motive as to why the boys would have chosen the home of James Smiley that night and why the eventual crimes mainly committed by Venegas became so brutal. Likely, the other two victims, Daniel Duenas and Ruben Martinez, were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. But that is Cynthia's own supposition. Again, the main reason you've heard of this case is because of episode 4 of I Am a Killer. The producers play a clip of Judge Flores talking about why the three boys may have gone to James Smiley's home that night. He says, quote, "They were talking about going to trash a house," which means vandalization, burglarization, "to do something bad to someone who appeared to be good, but was really bad," end quote. Miguel has then played this audio clip, from Judge Flores. His response to the producers was very emotional and revealing. Quote, "What did it mean? I think it's very clear what it means. I think the question is, what is the bad?" End quote. So again, here, we're seeing something that kind of gives us an idea that there might be a motive for some other reason why they went there that night.
Okay, so the story that is emerging that you know, clearly Martinez's new attorney is proposing is this idea, and correct me if I'm wrong. So the idea is at some point Martinez maybe hinted at his friends or even told his friends that this guy was an abuser, he hurt boys, he hurt him, et cetera, or at least just basically told them this guy's a piece of garbage and it would be nice to take some revenge on him.
Yeah, maybe scare him or rough him up or something.
Burglarize the house, yeah. Vandalize the house. So that's how they made the decision as to what residence they were going to hit that night. So they go to the Smiley residence, break in, and Venegas goes into his schizophrenic mental illness / satanic frenzy or, you know, whatever that they want to describe it as. And he viciously kills all three people in that house with Martinez still present, but not exactly participating in the murders.
And also kind of forcing him to stab the one victim, reportedly.
It would be nice to know, as far as autopsy results are, from that victim, Ruben Martinez, who was found on the couch. It would be nice because if you could find stab wounds that look a little bit different, that are kind of hesitant, a lot of times you can tell.
Or shallow,
yeah. Or
superficial.
At a different part of the body, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. It would be nice to know if we had those kinds of details, if there's something obvious with those wounds that we can point to and say, yeah, those were the stab wounds and they're different from all of the other wounds that any of the bodies sustained.
Yep, I agree.
But I'm assuming we don't have that.
We don't.
Yeah.
I don't have any answers for you there, but those are all good questions and you're definitely keeping us on track with our vision of what's going on in this case. So Miguel's final moments of that particular I Am a Killer episode that everybody's talking about right now are crystallized by the following thoughts. Quote, "There are still some things that I personally haven't completely dealt with. I've dealt with them to be able to move on, to not have them be an anchor around my neck, but it's like there's just a longer chain and the anchor is still there, connected. For so many years, it seemed the way for me to deal with things was to take myself, put myself aside, and think about the other people involved. And in a way, just think that whatever happens to me is just a small thing. I can handle that and I'll deal with it." End quote. At this point, Miguel clearly becomes emotional and he's very tearful. And the end of this episode raises so many questions that still have not been answered. He still doesn't want to talk about why he was in that house that night, really. And his true relationship with James Smiley and what really happened that evening.
Yeah, that quote that you just read, it almost sounds like he is still holding something back, that he's not been completely honest about maybe his actions that night.
Yeah. Whether it's the 1999 Swedish documentary that some people have watched, or if it's the I Am a Killer episode, Miguel's case has captivated audiences and drawn people to his version of the events that night. And we still don't know the truth. In 2006, Miguel's death sentence was actually commuted to life after a successful final appeal with his lawyer, Cynthia Orr. He has been eligible for parole ever since, but continues to be denied based on the vicious acts and the planning phases of the crime. Before that, Miguel came up for execution twice within 48 hours of executed. Yeah. Again, he was defended by somebody who was a divorce lawyer, who was a public attorney. He was offered a sentence of life with parole originally, but that lawyer denied it and said he should plead innocent.
Let's be clear. A lawyer can't make those decisions.
Well, he advised him.
Yeah, he advised him to do that, which we see that happen a lot, though. We see a lot of people, go one way or the other when... And then it's like, oh, well, I really should have taken that plea deal, shouldn't I?
Yeah, certainly. But what does it say about Miguel that he chose to plead innocent the whole time and continues to do so to this day, And while in prison, he achieved a certification as a paralegal and represented himself during several successful appeals before he got his wrongful conviction lawyer. And Miguel still contests that he was coerced into stabbing an already dead victim by an aggressive Satanist who he barely even knew until that night because he feared for his life. It's also an interesting counterpoint that Miguel has never gone into detail about his relationship with James Smiley, why he offered his home as a potential target that night, and whether the attack was in fact driven by hatred for Smiley and his actions against him. After researching this case, I've come to agree with Cynthia Orr that Miguel deserves a complete new retrial. Based on everything that has come to light since his original trial 25 years ago, you know, the forensics that have been botched, the political corruption that was going on, the FBI charges, the forced confession, the axe that was used to chop up a Christmas tree. I also think it's ridiculous that someone who is arguably possibly an accessory to murder could receive such a sentence this quickly, this fast, and be that close to execution. That is terrifying. And when interviewed in the Laredo Law documentary, Venegas was asked twice if he believed Miguel Martinez was in fact innocent. Both times he said yes.
Wow. So Venegas even says Miguel really didn't have anything to do with this.
Yep. Venegas has numerous times accepted full responsibility for the three murders that night, blaming his satanic practices, his drug use, and unproven allegations regarding Smiley as possible reasons. Finally, let's talk about the one missing person in this group, Milo Flores.
Oh, great. Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
He still lives with his parents. His father, Manuel Flores Sr., is the one who always comes out at documentaries and interviews and with journalists to defend his son and talk about the case and protect him. And he says that is to shelter him and that he's a good boy. And, you know, he's also a father now. I guess I should say that. He has a child. And, yeah, he's doing his best to protect Milo from everyone who would try to ask him the hard questions. But I do have one little snippet for you. Back in 1999, Folk Ryden caught up with Milo at the hospital that he was currently working at and asked him if he felt any guilt that Miguel Martinez was still on death row. His response was very interesting and telling. He said, quote, "Let me think about this." And he paused for a long moment, and then he said, "I feel a little bit uncomfortable with your question," end quote. Shortly after that, he declined any further comment and left abruptly. Clearly in this video, the question startles Milo, and he also answered several questions leading up to this one. But he couldn't formulate, you know, an answer in respect to Miguel and Miguel's situation, and that's the one that made him leave the interview. So is there something more going on there? I don't know. He clearly doesn't want to talk about Miguel Martinez.
As far as Venegas and Miguel Martinez go, have their stories ever changed in regards to Milo being there, not being there?
Both of them have kind of insinuated in interviews that Milo played a bigger role than he's leading on to. There is one quote from Miguel referring to Milo that his role was a little bit more involved and leading on to the idea that he might have actually been at James Smiley's house there. But again, he's kind of taking the whole responsibility onto himself and trying to deal with it in his own way and not want to involve anyone else. So it's hard to say, but both Venegas and Miguel have kind of insinuated Milo's role was a little bit bigger than we know it to be.
Hmm.
And that's what leads everyone to have all of their problems with a judge's son not having any charges in this case.
I mean,
and all the evidence being destroyed.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. All of that looks very, very bad. But I mean, at the same time, let's say Milo's story is true, that he thought that these two guys were just going to break into this house, maybe steal some stuff. He dropped them off. He left. The next time he met them, he found out that three people had been murdered. And then so eventually when the police did catch up to them, he decided, hey, I'm going to tell you guys everything I know. I'm going to work with you. I'm going to testify against these two guys.
That's true.
So again, even though it does look very suspicious,
he did cooperate.
It also makes sense because, you know, a lot of the time we get people who, hey, if they go to the police first, if they talk first, if they're willing to testify against others, then they're not going to get charged or they'll get some sort of very, very special plea deal.
But there's also in the appeals hearing those sworn statements of the secret meeting between DA Rubio and Judge Flores before the investigation even declared a major suspect.
Yeah.
He did come forward. He did turn over the murder weapons because they were still at his house at the property. He did give those over to police and, you know, give his statement and everything.
Oh, okay. I was wondering. I thought that they had just been recovered at the house. So
they were in his shed, still at the property.
Okay.
And he gave those over to police. But I don't know. I don't want to say anything else about Milo and his involvement, but there are questions around it.
No, for sure. I mean, there's questions every which way you look in this case, right? Because we really don't have an answer as to what happened there at all.
Yeah, we just have kind of some allegations and some kind of clues that there was something else going on. And I think that leaves all of our listeners and you and I in the same boat where we have to kind of make our own decisions as to there probably was something else going on in this case. What was it? We don't know. But it probably isn't the story that was laid out to us in the first two trials. Thus, all the appeals that have happened ever since. Venegas and Martinez have undergone multiple successful appeals in their cases.
Yeah.
So when you go through those appeals processes, you see that judges are actually ruling that there were problems, real problems in their cases.
So what does it take for a retrial to happen?
I don't know. But if anybody knows, Cynthia Orr does, because she's a really good lawyer and she's all about this wrongful conviction case. And that's what she's really pushing for. And, you know, his family, Miguel Martinez, his brother, his sister, his mother, a lot of his family have been pushing for his innocence. And they have a bunch of petitions and pages that you can go and follow and find more details about his case online. They've stood by him this whole time.
Yeah. It's really interesting because it's very much, it reminds you of all of the major true crime, possible false conviction stories that we have out there, of course. With Anand Syed,
Stephen Avery,
and even Michael Peterson, when it comes to his initial conviction, was based off of very faulty blood spatter analysis that was presented in court. And it's one of those things where I don't personally, I have differing levels of whether or not I think they're innocent or guilty. Some of them I do think probably guilty. Some of them I think are probably innocent. But when you think about those three cases, especially when it comes to Stephen Avery or Adnan Syed, what bothers you is not really whether or not they did it per se. It's whether things were presented in a way that is fair in a justice system in the year 2018 in a civilized country.
Yeah. And I agree. In all those cases, I feel like it could have been done much better. There should have been much more clarity and we should know all the facts in those cases. And that's how I feel about this case. I feel like there's so many questions surrounding it that at this point you almost have to have a retrial based on the things that I mentioned, political corruption, loss of evidence, all that kind of stuff.
And ultimately it's also really frustrating because then what happens is the media circus and everything surrounding these cases focuses so much on the alleged perpetrator / real perpetrator so much that the names of the victims get lost. And I mean, just now when I was talking about those three cases, I talked about all of the alleged perpetrators and not the victims themselves. And we know so little about Smiley.
But
what about the 14-year-old boy?
Yeah, what about David Duenez? What about Ruben Martinez?
Exactly.
Where do they all get lost in this case?
And so that's what happens when we have these kinds of cases where things get ramrodded through. Evidence is falsified or it's presented in a way that's pseudoscientific and all of these bad things happen. And then 10 years later, people go, oh, well, that was really bad. And so like the victims never get real justice and they get forgotten. And that's so frustrating.
It is. It really is. And but that's the same reason why I thought this was a perfect case for us to do, because when it comes down to it, these are the cases that you and I get really impassioned about.
Oh, everybody.
Everyone does. Anyone who's an armchair detective or a true crime fan these are the cases you want to research and you really get fascinated about and you start digging. I mean, I wish I had months and months and months to read more and more and more about this case because there's so much more I could have gotten into and there's so many other things that I'd love to talk about, but I don't have any of that time because we're already over an hour in this episode. Yeah. So, yeah, but that's the whole reason we're doing this, you know?
No, it's interesting. I mean, it's definitely, I'm glad that you were able to bring a little bit more light on this case because I had never heard of it. I've never seen the I Am a Killer TV show. I've never heard of this case.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's lots of other people who maybe haven't heard about it either, or maybe just saw that episode, but need additional details to really kind of make up their mind.
I would just say we need to keep a focus on this one and we need to see if anything else happens with Miguel Martinez's case moving forward. If he does end up getting a retrial, if he ever does get parole, and just see how it all develops. And if there's anything else that comes out about it, it'd be really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I'd be interested to hear what listeners have to say in response to this episode, too, because it's just, I feel like there's a thousand things going through my mind right now as to questions I have and things that aren't right.
It was a hard episode to write and to
kind of find
a middle ground. There's a lot of personal opinion in this case, and a lot of people have taken it into some directions. And I wanted to stay close to what we knew.
Yeah.
Which is what we do on the show.
Yeah. No, that was absolutely fascinating. Like, I want to go research some more myself and find out some more information, but I'm sure you did an excellent job summarizing what's available right now.
Yeah, go check it out.
I'm going to have to watch that episode now, aren't I?
Man, it's interesting. And also, like, another thing I'll finally say is, like, how much can you trust anything that Venegas says?
Including him being the sole responsible party?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's a self-proclaimed Satanist, a schizophrenic. He's got mental problems and he loves talking to the media. Hmm. So it's like that Henry Lee Lucas thing. Like, I'll take everything you say, Venegas, with a grain of salt.
Yeah, I mean, if he is like Richard Ramirez level Satanist, I am the son of the devil and I do these things because the devil empowers me to do them, that kind of Satanist, then, you know, him killing three people himself might be a victory in his head. So that's why he really wants to claim that.
Yeah.
Again, I have no idea, but I'm just saying, like, that's another possibility.
He comes off pretty machismo-y.
Yeah.
You know?
Man, that's some crazy stuff, man.
Yeah, and Miguel Martinez comes off like the quiet honor student that's, you know, reserved, introverted, well thought out. You know, can argue his own case and talk clearly about things.
Yeah. Which, of course, can be a...
It's definitely been used as a point against him that, like, oh, he is smart. Like, he's the ringleader. You know, like, he's just hiding his true guilt.
Yeah.
He's arguing his case better.
Well, you know, it's just like anything. Anything can be argued one way or the other.
Yeah.
Anything.
But the thing is like, in this case, the true facts and the true forensics and the data are all thrown out the window at this point.
And we don't have that anymore. Yeah. So we only have speculation and gut feeling to go on, which is never good.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Well, that was really good. I am going to be thinking on this case for days now, I think. But in the meantime, we have some good news. And this is also another listener submitted good news. And we'll be getting to that in just a second after these messages from our sponsors. Well, we've got another listener email this week for good news, and I think this is actually a really good setup for what we can do for the rest of the month. So if you live in Texas and you work for a charity, or if you have any knowledge of anything's going around in your area, send us an email and we will put it in the show. I think it's a great way to kind of celebrate Texas, community, charity, and all of the things that you can be doing right now. A lot of people like to help out during the holidays, so I think that's a really great way to celebrate it.
Yeah, and you know we love a good charity here at ACNC, so always ready to help on our end.
All right, well, this email comes from Shannon from Waco, and she says, I work for Mission Waco, a great nonprofit here in Waco that helps with people of all kinds, including the poor and marginalized. We have a Christmas toy store where parents can buy toys for 20% of the ticket price, so they're able to provide for their kids with dignity, not a handout. Anyway, every year we have the Biker Toy Run. Bikers from all over Texas visit various churches and bring hundreds of toys to the church under the bridge as the final stop. Those toys line the front of the church, which is under I-35 bridge outside by Baylor, and then they go to the toy store. It's a great sight to see all of these big burly guys and ladies with dolls and teddy bears. And she says you can see for yourself on our Facebook page and at www.missionwaco.org. And she closes it with saying, thanks, still waiting on non-Branch Davidian Waco stories.
We have some more that we have planned, but you'll have to find out when they pop up in your feed.
Yeah, and a little bit more information about Mission Waco. This comes from their website. They mobilize middle-class Americans to become more compassionately involved among the poor. They seek ways to overcome the systemic issues of social injustice which oppress the poor and marginalized. And so they have relationship-based programs that empower the poor and marginalized. And it looks like, according to the Waco Tribune Herald Reader's Choice, they were, in 2018, they were rated the number one first place nonprofit agency in Waco.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a great title to have.
Yeah, absolutely. So this sounds like a really great organization. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they accept donations, gifts, you know, donate your time if you can, if you're in that area. Sounds like a really great organization. And again, we've seen those biker toy drives around.
Yeah, they're pretty awesome.
They're really amazing when you get to see them on the highway. All these, like, dudes and ladies all But, like, they always decorate their bikes and they have silly stuff. And it's just...
like Christmas lights on them and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just the cutest thing. And it's really nice to see people going out of their way, especially this time of the year.
Well, and it breaks the stereotype up as well about the ornery beer-drinking biker groups. Bikers actually do a ton of really great charity work.
They do. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, really fantastic stuff. So thank you so much, Shannon. We will be working on a Waco episode, I'm sure. It'll come one day.
So next up on the show, we have our recommendations section. And today we're going to talk a little bit about one of the shows that's kind of a friend of ours. And the show we're talking about this week, it's Killer Jobs. They're kind of a newer show, but that's what we like to do with this segment, is to forecast stuff that you should probably be getting on and listening to. And if you like true crime, Chris, the host, has an interesting take on what he does with the show. He has a background in criminal forensics, and he's very interested in what makes serial killers tick. And his show really focuses on the niche of what are serial killers' day jobs. So I was immediately interested in this one, and I saw that he covered BTK, which is one of the serial killers that I always find fascinating, and I read a lot of stuff about BTK. He included information about BTK from people who worked with him, bosses, co-workers, family members, and it was just really interesting. It's a neat take on true crime and the study of serial killers.
Yeah, it's very unique. It's a different aspect of their life than what we usually focus on when we talk about serial killers. And it's one that I think is really interesting because, you know, we spend a good portion of our life at work.
Yeah.
And so it's like, what kind of relationships did these people have? What kind of workers were they? What kind of employment history did they have? So did they move around and jump from job to job, or were they employed at the same company for 30 years? So it's all really interesting. And he always compares and contrasts each serial killer that he's talked about previously. So you can kind of be like, okay, well, this guy was like this guy, but he's also really different than this guy. So yep. It's interesting.
It is. He does a really good job and he does really good research. And yeah, I think you'll like it. So go check it out. And here's his promo right here.
Hey, this is Chris, the host of Killer Jobs, the podcast that discovers the day jobs of the world's most famous serial killers. Explore how these psychopaths functioned in the real world, how murder interfered with their work, and what coworkers had to say. Killer Jobs investigates a new serial killer every Tuesday and is available on all podcast players.
All right, and on to one of our favorite things to do, which is to give shout-outs to everybody who has supported this show over the last month and who will be going into December. This is our December Patreon shout-outs. And we got to start with the Queen. The Queen of the Hill, the Master of the Keep, And that's our Texas Ranger, Lisa L. She's the best.
Woo!
Yep. Thank you for all your support, Lisa, and for helping produce the show and do a lot for the fans and our community. We appreciate it. Next up is our small town sheriffs, and that includes Ashley P., Rebecca, Jamie B., Heather N., and Deborah H. Thank y'all so much for just keeping it down.
Yeah.
It's hard to be a small town sheriff.
But you know what? Those guys, they took up the mantle, and they're doing a great job.
They are. Next is our lone guns. These are our wild and risky desperados that are lurking out in the arroyos and the Caprock countryside. These include Claire J., Kara J., Megan L., Alyssa F., Kaya A., Jisoo K., Lauren M., Megan J., Mindy M., Karen P., Marshall B., Amanda N., Emily H., Ann N., Sam M., The Gone Cold Podcast, Elizabeth M., Karen B., and ARF. Now, on to our little deputies that we couldn't do this without. You have a special place in the ACNC family, and we appreciate you being here. Those are Gary D., Kelly R., Gracie B., Danielle D., the podcast Murder and Such, Marianne Connor, the podcast Corpus Delecti, the podcast True Crime Fan Club, Jessica M., Donald Brown, Kate from Ignorance Was Bliss, Erica from Southern Fried True Crime, Christina S., and that's it.
Yeah. Hey, hey, hey. Woo. Underlay, underlay.
Hee-haw.
There you go. You know you're special when Shea breaks out his stupid sound machine. No, you're done. You're done.
We gotta get out of here.
Hopefully you know by now, but we did tell you on the Patreon episode and we told you on the Patreon website, but we do have a little present coming to all of our patrons who are contributing to the show at $5 or more a month. You have a small present coming your way for the holidays. Just a little thank you from us to you for being so wonderful and supporting the show. We really appreciate you guys and we love you.
Yeah, happy holidays, you guys. And check your mailboxes for that soon. And yeah, should be great. Until next time. Crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.